You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, knots in space.
And so there are theories of physics which predict that not only do these phase transitions take place in the early universe, but you will also get defects forming in the universe.
Using physics to calculate the fate of civilization.
So we're in this, what I think of as an expanding socio-economic universe. And, you know, is there an end of time, so to speak, of socio-economic time, meaning that the kind of quality and standard of living to which we've grown accustomed.
And finding the fuel for time travel.
And so the question is the negative energy that can come from quantum mechanics sufficient to allow us to curve space and time in just the right way that would allow us to travel into the past?
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster.
Welcome to the FQXI podcast. We'll start off by congratulating Charles Bennett of Johns Hopkins University and the whole WMAP team, who have just been awarded this year's Gruber Prize in Cosmology. WMAP, that's the Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe, launched in 2001 and made precision measurements of the relic radiation of the Big Bang, the cosmic microwave background, which helped to pin down the age, the geometry, the makeup, and the early history of the universe.
WMAP stopped taking data in 2010, but astronomers and cosmologists are still analysing that data to learn more about the makeup of the cosmos. In particular, FQXI member Hiranya Pieris and Stephen Feeney at University College London and their colleagues have been searching for signs of cosmic textures, knots in the fabric of space. I met up with Hiranya and Stephen and asked them about their findings. Hiranya began by running through some of WMAP's biggest hits so far.
So before WMAP, the cosmological parameters that describe the origin, the evolution, the geometry of the universe were sometimes uncertain to factors of 10 and sometimes to factors of 2, you know. But since WMAP, some of those parameters have now been measured to sub-percent precision. So cosmology went from being quite a big idea, speculative, hand-waving science, to being a precise science so that we can formulate theories of the early universe that we can't test in the laboratory because this is physics at very, very high energies, and make predictions for the properties of the cosmic microwave background and actually rule out theories, compare theories. I would say that the big hits of WMAP have basically been the measurement of the age of the universe. So now it's known to be 13.7 plus or minus 0.1 billion years. And I think that this is actually stated in the Guinness Book of World Records as the most precise determination of the age of the universe. So this is something that mankind had been, you know, wondering about for a very long time, and that was, you know, the first precise determination. Also, another big question that existed about the universe as a whole was, what was its geometry? Was it open, or was it closed, or was it flat? And WMAP has determined, in combination with other data, that the universe is flat, that it is Euclidean to within a percent. So those two are very big questions that it has been able to answer. It's also been able to make the first tests of the physical mechanism that led to the origin of all the structure in the universe. So before WMAP, there were many, many theories for the origin of structure, which I think we're going to talk about in a little bit, and as well as this theory called inflation.
And now, can you just tell us a little bit about what inflation is?
So we know that the present universe is accelerating in its expansion. And probably the best explanation for that, at least at the moment, is that there is a non-zero vacuum energy in space. And that's causing the space to expand very, very rapidly and accelerate in its expansion. So this is called the cosmological constant. And this cosmological constant actually today is very, very small. OK, Okay, but a similar process might have occurred in the very early universe. We are talking about something like 10 to the minus 33 seconds after the initial time. The value of the cosmological constant could have been much, much bigger and caused the universe to expand by a factor of about 10 to the 30 in about 10 to the minus 33 seconds. It's just inconceivable, the process we're talking about. But we see our universe doing that today, so it's not inconceivable that it could have been doing that in the past. So inflation also provides a very elegant mechanism for the origin of structure in the universe. So in this theory, structure originated as quantum mechanical fluctuations in the so-called inflaton field, which is driving this big spurt of growth very early on. So as the universe expanded so rapidly, these little fluctuations were stretched out. And they were stretched out and they got imprinted into universe-sized kind of little ripples in space. And so everything that we see today could have originated from the action of quantum mechanics, which is just mind-boggling, but it's really, really cool.
I like the term universe-sized little ripples. I think only a cosmologist could say that. So that's sort of, you know, we've discussed what WMAP is sort of famous for having achieved, but are there things that we can still look to WMAP for at the moment to find out, you know, more things about the early universe? And here I'm taking you towards a paper that you recently published with Stephen Feeney and other colleagues.
So WMAP itself has basically been turned off. It was turned off in September of 2010 after a very nice period of taking data. It worked beautifully. But this data set can still teach us about new physics that could have occurred in the early universe. I should also say, though, that the Planck satellite was launched in 2009, and it also has beautiful data, which I can't talk about, but which will be released, at least with the cosmological results, in January in next year. So, you know, we don't have to wait that long for that. But in the meantime, people who are not on the Planck team still use WMAP to do very cool things. So one of them is Stephen Feeney, my student, and he has just been testing an alternative theory for the origin of structure, which used to be one of the contenders back in the day before WMAP. It's no longer a contender for originating all the structure in the universe, but there could still be minor components of the cosmological fluctuations that are sourced by these sort of theories. Two examples are cosmic strings and cosmic textures. So I will pass the mic to Stephen to talk about these.
Well, thank you, Hirania, for that explanation, and hello, Stephen. Can you explain to us what cosmic strings are and what cosmic textures are and how they are related to structure formation, as Hirania introduced there?
As Hirania already began saying, when the universe was very young, it was very hot and dense. And as it expanded, it started cooling. And so we know from lots of much more mundane forms of physics that when you cool things, they can undergo phase transitions. So for example, you cool liquid water, it will freeze into ice. And when these processes take place slowly, specifically the transition from water to ice takes place very smoothly, you get a crystal that has a very rigid structure all the way through, and it's very uniform throughout. If these processes take place quickly, then the structure of the crystals that you form are only uniform over short distances. And so you can have regions of the crystal that are large distances away that look kind of different. And the interfaces between these regions, you form defects. So for example, if you look at an ice cube, it's cloudy, right? It's not a kind of perfectly see-through thing. And so there are theories of physics which predict that not only do these phase transitions take place in the early universe, but you will also get defects forming in the universe. And there are a lot of different types of defects that you can get depending on the phase transition that takes place. And so if you get defects that are very long 2D string-like objects, they're called cosmic strings. You can also get kind of sheets forming, which are called domain walls. And if you get a kind of complex phase transition taking place, you can get these weird 3D blobby things called cosmic textures.
So you explained how, you know, if we think about water turning to ice, we have a phase transition and we can see these defects appearing. When we talk about the universe, what are these phase transitions? Are there any examples of what they might be?
So when Hirani was talking about the inflaton field earlier, right, you can have a number of fields in the early universe, and a very famous one of these is the Higgs field, so it's very zeitgeist. It's the the field which gives the particles mass, and it has a potential energy associated with it, which gives the field certain symmetries. And as the temperature of the universe cools, the potential that it's in changes, and it can break some of these symmetries. Essentially, gives the universe choices as to the configuration that it takes. And so whenever something like this happens, you can have one part of the universe going into one configuration and another part of the universe that's further away going into another configuration. And there will be a region within where you have to transfer between these two configurations, and that's where you'll get a defect forming.
And why did cosmologists at one point think these might have been responsible for structure formation, or indeed, you know, what role do they think they could still play today?
Yeah, so different defects have different kind of energy densities. So something like a domain wall, they have a lot of energy associated with them. And so if they form, then they would essentially rule out cosmologies like the ones we see today. So insofar as if you have a theory that predicts that they take place, then we shouldn't be here. But there are other types of defects, such as the strings and textures, which are much more benign. And so, I mean, initially they thought that these objects could form the seeds of structure, but as Hirani said, WMAP managed to rule out textures and strings forming the bulk of the fluctuations that we see in the cosmic microwave background today. However, there's no reason why they can't still have taken place, and they would just be a very small contribution to the CMB that we see.
So I guess a few years ago, some people did think they might have found something that looked like it might be a texture. So can you talk a little bit about what happened there and what people were looking at?
Yeah, so this is a group. So it's a series of papers by Cruz et al., also featuring Neil Turok, where they looked at a specific feature in the cosmic microwave background, which is known as the cold spot, rather imaginatively. It's a very small feature. It represents about 3% of the data on the full sky. But I think it's probably safe to say that it's by far the most anomalous thing in the CMB, or single feature at least. I should say, if textures exist in the universe, then they interact with the CMB photons to produce a set of hot or cold spots, all of which should have the same amplitude. And so they thought, well, we've got a cold spot here, let's see whether or not it looks like a texture. And they did, and they concluded that the data were consistent with being explained by a texture. It's a very good analysis. It's just that in these things, this is a kind of global process. We should be looking at the data on the full sky.
And so in this paper that you recently published, what did you do and what did you find?
Essentially, what we did was to look at the full sky WMAP data rather than just a very small patch of it. And in order to do so, we needed to kind of change tack. We need to come up with a way of handling all of this extra data. And the way that we do this is by splitting the algorithm into two parts, the first of which identifies regions on the sky which are the most likely to be textures. And then we assume that all the rest of the sky is just boring and normal. And then we test all of these little patches to see whether or not they're consistent with the texture hypothesis. And when we look into the full sky data rather than just a little region, we find that there's no real evidence to support the addition of textures into the standard model of cosmology.
You know, you've given such a lovely explanation of why these phase transitions occur and we should see these defects. Is it in some sense surprising that solid evidence for them hasn't been found? Are you basically expecting that there should be some evidence for them?
I guess that's an interesting question. So the number of these defects that you expect to see depends on the specific theory that produces them, or the specific symmetry that's broken and when it's broken. So I guess there's always a chance that you could be unlucky and that they take place rarely or high enough energies so that you can't see them in the CMB, so that it would be something that takes place before inflation or something like that. So I guess it's not necessarily surprising that we haven't found them, as they could be weak and there could be a very small number of them. But it would be very cool if we could find them.
So what next? Are you waiting for data from Planck to try and find out a bit more about this question?
Well, so as Hirani was saying, the Planck data is coming out in January. so it's not that long to wait. But yeah, I mean, I gave you a simplification of the results before. When you look into a more full explanation of the results, you do see that there's something interesting in there. So that there is potentially a weak signal. It might just be that the data are too noisy for us to rule out the model completely. With Planck data, it's very exciting because they're better quality than WMAP. There's a kind of factor of 10 or so improvement in noise and stuff, which means that we'll be able to subject this hypothesis to a much more rigorous test and potentially find weaker signals. And also, there are other data sets that we can take advantage of, so polarization data being one of them.
What does this polarization data tell us? What is it, and what new information can it reveal?
The polarization data essentially tells you about the orientation of the light that's coming in, but it also tells you more about what's happened between us and the CMB. And as those photons interact with, for example, textures, you can get different patterns being imprinted on the polarization data. So you can use this as essentially corroborating evidence.
Okay, so Stephen, you mentioned the Higgs field, and I think, you know, the Higgs has been in the news for the past few weeks, and it probably will be again in the next few days. If there is an announcement made about the Higgs, perhaps the discovery of the Higgs, would that be of interest to you as a cosmologist in any way?
Yeah, I think personally it would, but purely because the Higgs field is a scalar field, and scalar fields are things that a lot of kind of current cosmology is built upon. The inflaton is, the most infamous scalar field, I would say. But they've never been observed, and so this would be the first concrete observation of a scalar field, something that is quite foundational in cosmology that, I mean, I wouldn't say that people take them for granted, but I might.
That was Hiranya Pyrrhus and Stephen Feeney chatting to Zia. You can find more on the website www.fqxi.org/community, where co-author Matthew Johnson of the Perimeter Institute blogs about the results in more detail. There's also a profile of Hiranya Pyrrhus by Miriam Frankel, and we're also running an extended version of that interview on the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, which is definitely worth a listen if you've ever looked at images of the cosmic microwave background and wondered exactly how astronomers and cosmologists can work out so much about the universe just by looking at the distribution of spots across the sky.
Yeah, so during that interview, I brought up the Higgs with Stephen Feeney because, of course, there's a big announcement scheduled for July the 4th.
Uh-huh, another big Higgs announcement.
Well, okay, we don't know what they're going to say yet, but regardless of whether they found the Higgs or not, I really enjoyed Stephen Feeney's point that physicists more or less take the existence of scalar fields, of which the Higgs field is one example, for granted. And we use them in cosmology now without a second thought.
So this is my subtle cue to say that physicists should really be questioning their assumptions. And that's what we're asking them to do in this year's FQXI essay contest, Questioning the Foundations.
Yes, so we announced that the contest is up and running in last month's podcast. Any news on how that's going, Brendan?
Oh yes, entries are now appearing online. I think we have at least 30 so far, and they should continue to arrive, exponentially increasing as we get closer to the deadline at the end of August. So people should check the site every few days to see new entries. You can visit the site, you can read the essays, give them a rating, you can ask the author questions in the online forums. If you follow us on Twitter at FQXI, you can get updates about the entries as they come in. And we're already seeing lots of interesting ideas and entrants who are attempting to take physics in whole new directions.
That brings me on to our next guest. Taking physics in new directions will certainly appeal to Jeffrey West at the Santa Fe Institute. West has built a career as a particle physicist, but over the past decade or so, he has turned the mathematics he learned onto complex systems. He and his colleagues have been looking for underlying equations that apply to the growth, life, and deaths of animals, and also of cities. He spoke to me about how his work in biology and socioeconomics has given him a new sense of what time is and what it tells us about how much time we have left.
The work started out actually in biology, and one of the remarkable things that one finds in biology is that despite this extraordinary complexity and diversity, almost any quantity you look at, any physiological quantity or life history event, scales with size in a very systematic way. Scaling just means how does it change as you change the size of the organism. And one of the crucial pieces of that is the role of time. And one of the things that we have discovered as we formulated a theoretical conceptual framework for understanding the origin of these systematic scaling laws was that there is kind of an emergent time that is different than the time that we read on our clock. But there is a biological time which emerges, which is quite interesting because what it says is that there is a systematic relationship between the pace of life and the size of the organism. So an example is that heart rate, which is again a beating phenomenon, it is a certain measure of time, changes systematically among mammals as you go from, say, the smallest mammal to the largest mammal. We all recognize that small mammals' hearts beat very, very fast, you know, up to 1,000 times a minute, all the way to a whale, which beats at an extraordinarily slow rate, and we're somewhere in between, so that you can define a kind of universal time for, say, all mammals. And one of the ways you can see that is this kind of amusing relationship that the way in which heart rate, for example, decreases with size, the slowing of the pace of life, is in some sense compensated for by the fact that big things live systematically longer. And they do it in such a way that roughly, very roughly, the shrew, which weighs, you know, 2 or 3 grams, a few grams, has the same number, roughly the same number of heartbeats in its lifetime as does a whale, which is 100 million times more massive. And that number is about 1.5 billion heartbeats. Now, there's nothing fundamental about heartbeats, but what is fundamental and which transcends beyond mammals is the number of times the reaction takes place deep inside the cell, producing something called ATP, which is the chemical which is actually responsible for your energy. And it is those constraints that lead to the scaling laws and which lead to this emergent kind of time.
You haven't just been looking at animals. You've also been looking at cities and companies. Can you talk a bit about that and what that sort of tells us about time and perhaps even, you know, how much time we have left?
Yes, this is a very interesting problem. And it was very natural to ask similar questions about social organizations. Is a city just a great big animal? So just as we saw in biology that in some sense an elephant is a scaled up mouse, so we discovered that New York is a scaled up San Francisco, which is a scaled up Santa Fe, which is where I live. And we did that by looking across the many measurable characteristics of cities, everything from wages to number of patents that are produced in the city, to the number of AIDS cases, the amount of crime, the length of all the roads, and so on. Everything you could measure, we looked at as a function of city size and found a systematic relationship. Now, in biology, the scaling that was manifested had the following property, that it did scale, but it scaled in such a way that it manifested something that's called economies of scale, meaning the following: that not only does life slow down as you get bigger, but you get a greater economy of scale, meaning the amount of energy needed to support the same number of cells gets smaller and smaller as you get bigger. So it's more efficient to be bigger in biology. Now, when we switch over to cities, we discovered something new, which is different from biology, and that is instead of having economies of scale in socioeconomic quantities like wages and AIDS cases and patents and so on, we discovered there was something that we called a superlinear relationship, which is that instead of getting less per capita the bigger you are, you get more per capita. So the bigger the city, the higher wages, the more number of AIDS cases, the more patents are produced, all to the same degree. One of the consequences of that is that that gives rise to the speeding up of the pace of life the bigger you are rather than the slowing down. So the bigger the city, the faster everything goes, even to the extent that the speed of walking remarkably increases with the size of a city in a pretty much systematic way. But then you ask about growth. For cities, you have open-ended growth. Now, that's good at first sight, but it has a huge pitfall. And that pitfall is that the equations have something that technically we call a finite time singularity. Now, what that means in sort of ordinary English is that if you keep going, you eventually, of course, run up against the potential of running out of resources, but you hit a point where the system is going to collapse. So you ask yourself, how are you going to get out of this? How did we get out of this? Why haven't we done it? And the answer is, and it's well known, I think, to everybody, that the way you do it is you have to make major innovations. You have to kind of change the paradigm, reset the clock, and start over again. So you discover coal, and that kind of has a total paradigm-shifting effect on the whole of culture, the whole of society, and it's as if you've started the clock over again. The catch is, so that's great, but the catch is that the theory says, yes, you can do this, but the price you pay is that you have to make innovations faster and faster and faster, so that it is as if, not only is the pace of life increasing, so that you're on this kind of accelerating treadmill that's getting faster and faster, but every once in a while you have to jump onto another treadmill which is going even faster, and then faster and faster you have to jump onto different treadmills. Well, that is, you know, eventually you, the system, is going to have a heart attack.
We're on this treadmill. When do we have to jump?
Well, let's say, you mean jump off?
Yes.
The time between the computer revolution and the IT revolution was maybe 20, 25 years. You know, so I had, you know, the idea is if the analog to that 10,000 years ago may have taken hundreds or maybe 1,000 years. So that's getting shorter and shorter, and that is not sustainable because eventually, obviously, if you take it reductio ad absurdum, you're going to have to make, you know, the analog to an IT revolution every 2 years, and this is crazy, you can't do that. So, in fact, my feeling, if you use the word jump, when should we be addressing this question? That the question should be minus 50 years. That is, we should have maybe been thinking about some of these issues 50 years or so ago. There's a kind of interesting issue that we're in this, what I think of as an expanding socioeconomic universe. And, you know, is there an end of time, so to speak, of socioeconomic time, meaning that the kind of quality and standard of living to which we've grown accustomed, and how can we smoothly transform into a stable situation, and is that conceivable? That is, and so one of the obvious questions is, can we have wealth creation, innovation, and the kind of exciting quality and standard of life that many of us in developed countries experience without this growth pressure? Or are they so intertwined that the system is destined to some kind of collapse?
Thank you to Jeffrey West there, who is telling Zia about how we are all doomed.
Yes, quite. If you would like to watch a video of a talk by Jeffrey West, and it's worth it to see the graphs that show the similarities and differences between the relationships for animals and for cities, then visit the website www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. But a word of warning, the language in that video may not be suitable for our younger listeners.
Well, he is talking about the end of civilization, so we can forgive him. Jeffrey West did say at the end there that we should have started to plan our next paradigm-shifting innovation 50 years ago. So if only we had a time machine to take us back to warn the great minds who were around then.
Ah, yes, time travel. And of course, FQXI is on the case. I've been speaking with FQXI member Ken Ollam, a physicist at Tufts University, who has been researching whether it's possible to find the materials needed to travel back in time. He started by telling me why physicists entertain the idea that time travel is possible at all.
Well, the issue is that according to general relativity, which is Einstein's theory of gravity, the effect of matter and energy is to curve space-time. So when you see an effect of gravity, something falls down to the Earth, that's really an effect of space-time being curved. Now, if space-time were curved enough, it might be possible to curve it back on itself in such a way that you could travel what would seem to you to always be into the future and nevertheless end up back in your own past.
So that sounds really exciting, but what are the possibilities of actually building a time machine?
Well, the trick to this is what kind of matter and energy you need as a source. General relativity is happy to produce any kind of space-time with some exotic properties, such as time travel, if you give it the right source. But the sources that you need for this type of exotic thing always involve energy which is negative. That is to say, you have to have something which has less energy than zero, less energy than the vacuum would have. Such things are possible in quantum mechanics, but only to a limited degree. And so the question is the negative energy that can come from quantum mechanics sufficient to allow us to curve space and time in just the right way that would allow us to travel into the past?
You've actually been looking into that possibility from a sort of a mathematical perspective. What answer have you come up with?
Well, we aren't certain yet, but I'm in the process of attempting to prove that such things cannot be done. And yes, wormholes travel faster than light, travel back into time. All of these things are very similar in the requirements that they have. And my feeling at this point is that none of them can be done. I'm trying to prove some theorems based on quantum field theory that show that quantum materials can never have the right kinds of negative energy that would allow this type of exotic thing to arise.
Are you a little bit disappointed about that? Was that what you initially set out to prove?
Yes, in a way, I am disappointed. It would be, of course, a great challenge to physics if one had time travel. We would have to reformulate the physical laws somehow to avoid the paradoxes of time travel, and no one knows how to do that. So from the point of view of making sense of physics, it's easier to not have time travel. But, you know, it would be fun. It would be the kind of thing everybody reads about it in science fiction. And I set out to see if this was possible. I tried various things. Some ideas that I had of how negative energies might be manipulated, and nothing seemed to work. And then, as in any kind of science, you have to go where research leads you, where your discoveries follow one another, and where you have to go. And where that was to see that there was some reason why none of these things were working, and that, in fact, perhaps this was impossible. So now I'm trying to settle the question one way or another, and it appears that the way it's going to be settled is in the other direction, that this type of exotic phenomenon is not possible.
And so what sort of paradoxes were you thinking about when you said that time travel opens up these paradoxes?
Well, you could think of the grandfather paradox, any type of changing the past. So you go back in time, you kill your grandfather, therefore your father or your mother wasn't born, therefore you weren't born, therefore you did not go back in time, therefore you did not kill your grandfather, he survived, you were born, and so on. This type of thing doesn't make any sense. You have to resolve it somehow. And this type of paradox carries over very directly into the laws of physics, how we can create a situation where physics should predict what's going to happen, and we can't predict anything. We can't even make any one sensible prediction because we face these paradoxes.
So I guess, as you say, it's a good thing if we could find a law that would explain why this doesn't happen.
Well, it certainly would avoid us having to solve a problem which no one has been able to solve and appears to be insoluble.
That was a short and sad interview with Ken Ollam telling Zia that it doesn't look like time travel will be possible.
Following on from an interview with Jeffrey West telling us that civilization as we know it probably can't be sustained.
And Pyrrhus and Feeney telling us that space does not seem to contain knots as far as they can see.
Yes, it's been a bit of a negative edition of the podcast, but thank you to all our contributors anyway. That's all for now. You can email us at podcast@fqxi.org and follow us on Twitter at FQXI. Maybe in the next edition we'll have some happy news about the Higgs, or maybe some of the essay contest entrants will have come up with some bright ideas for taking physics forward and saving the world.
Or maybe civilization will have ended and nobody will care anyway.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.